previously on Unsolved.
In 2009, I was heading up to another homicide conference up in Green Bay. And on my way up to Green Bay, I get a phone call from my boss, Ken Bagansky, at the time, the chief. And he says, I need you to come back. Greenfield has arrested this guy on a sexual assault case. And they uncovered information regarding the Zira case.
So at first, everything was pretty standard when they searched Acker's condo. The things that really disturbed them was when they got down to the basement, there was a model police station and a model fire station. And inside the walls were little pictures of dead and missing children. And above each one, there were these little LED lights that were programmed to light up, kind of like in a museum would be.
And these matchbox cars, and on the bottom of the matchbox cars were the names of all these victims from throughout the country. And obviously John Zira's picture and his name on a car was part of it.
Police also recovered a photo album and a journal about John's case, with entries that started in 1976 and spanned decades.
I've never seen anything like that before. It was like, oh man, I think we got something here that we need to look at. And he is a pedophile. There's no question about it. And his age preference is that early teens, 13 to 15 years of age, that ballpark.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, a murdered teen, a 40-year mystery. I'm Gina Barton. A word of warning for our listeners. This may go without saying on a podcast about a cold case homicide, but some of the content we're dealing with today is rather difficult. The day after 14-year-old John Zira's body was found, a police officer who was patrolling near the crime scene saw a guy ride up on a yellow Schwinn bicycle. And the guy started walking right toward the thicket where the body had been found. And so the cop went up to the guy and said, "Hey, who are you and what are you doing here?" And the man, whose name turned out to be Dan Acker, said, "I'm looking for the spot where Johnny Zira's body was found." And then he looked down and he saw some of John's blood that was still there on the ground. And he said, "Apparently this is it." The fact that Acker visited the crime scene would come up when the police questioned him in 2009 after he was accused of child molesting. He ended up being convicted of 2 counts of second-degree sexual assault of a child and is serving 20 years in prison.
What, do they actually think you were involved in it or something?
Yeah.
Oh.
Because I knew the park so well and I was at the crime scene.
Okay.
They took my name and all that good stuff. I was trying to find positions.
Right.
I wasn't morbid. This wasn't turning me on. This hurt me.
This wasn't the first time Acker got involved in this case. During the 8 days that John was missing back in 1976, Acker organized a search party in Whitnall Park. And he told the police that his training as a lifeguard led him to think that maybe John had drowned in one of the lagoons in the park. At some point after that, the police got a tip that Acker had an attraction for young teenage boys, and so they started looking into his past. Special Agent Harold Engelbart, he's deceased now, but at the time, he was an agent for the State Department of Justice. And so somehow, I'm not exactly sure how, the tip about Dan Acker and some of his past brushes with the law landed on Engelbart's desk. Back in the 1970s, before John's death, the police had been called about Dan Acker a few times. One time, his landlord was concerned that there was a parade of young boys coming in and out of his apartment. And so the landlord said, "You know, you can't do that anymore." Acker kept doing it, so they asked him to move out. And so he moved out, and then later on moved back in with the promise that he wouldn't have teenage boys spending time with him anymore. But shortly after he moved back in, there were these boys coming and going again. So the police actually staked out his apartment for a couple of days and managed to find one boy coming out of Acker's apartment, asked him if anything untoward was going on, and the kid said no. And then in the interim, when he had moved to a different apartment, there was a complaint that these two boys told their mother that Acker had asked them to pose for naked pictures and said he would pay them if they would pose naked for him to take pictures. So the police went and talked to Acker. He said it must have been some misunderstanding. He would never do that. The police asked Acker about that when they interrogated him in 2009.
Have you ever paid anybody like to pose naked so you could take pictures? Did you ever pay anybody for that?
No.
The other thing that's important to know about Dan Acker is that he was a foster parent. So as a single man, he had teenage boys as foster sons. And so he would obviously build relationship with these boys and their friends. He was also a swimming teacher and a lifeguard. So he would get to know young boys that way, too. Nowadays, the police call that grooming. They talk about how pedophiles put themselves in positions such as that where they'll have a lot of contact with young boys. And back in the 70s, I mean, all the police that I talked to said nobody really talked about child molesting or sex or pedophiles. And they just didn't want to make people uncomfortable by suggesting that maybe a kid was being abused. So when they talked to Acker and he said, oh, no, nothing's going on, it must have been a misunderstanding, they really didn't take it any further than that. Special Agent Harold Engelbart would question Dan Acker about John's death, but ultimately, Acker would be set aside as a suspect. Once again, the different jurisdictions had varying information about Acker. And since those jurisdictions weren't able to effectively communicate the way that they can today, nobody ever put those pieces all together. Also, Acker agreed to take a lie detector test. The first one was inconclusive thanks to, quote, erratic and inconsistent emotional responses. But he passed the second one. So even though we know now that lie detector tests aren't foolproof, the police figured the fact that he passed one meant he was probably innocent. But that wasn't the last time investigators heard from him. Back in the 70s and early 80s, Acker went on to launch his own investigation into John's death. He said he felt guilty that he hadn't biked to Whitnall Park the day John was killed, that perhaps he could have stopped the crime or somehow been there to help John or be with him as he died. Acker developed his own theory about the crime. He worked nights at the mental health complex in Milwaukee, and one of his patients there was a man named Joe. We're not going to use Joe's last name in this story because he's developmentally disabled, which makes him vulnerable. Acker's theory started with an incident on the grounds of that mental health facility, and he shared that theory with the police again and again, including during the 2009 interview.
We attacked a girl on our grounds. Rock. Same time of day, between one and two, this kid was killed. Anyway, I put it all together.
Okay.
I thought, oh, this is terrible.
So your patient attacked somebody on grounds?
He did, and I asked him why he did it, and when he said to me, because that's the way I saw him do it to the boy in the park.
Acker claimed three men picked up Joe at McDonald's, and when they did, John was in the back seat. Then they drove to Whitnall Park, where John tried to run away. And Joe supposedly told Acker that the men had a gun, and they forced him to chase John. And even though Joe didn't want to do it, he did, because he was afraid he would be shot if he didn't. So then Joe caught John, and the other men assaulted John and killed him.
He showed me what the injury was. He even pointed the correct side of the head. So that freaked me out. He knew the boy didn't have his jacket, but the guy gave him a jacket that was like this too long. He knew everything. He knew a lot. And he didn't read it in the paper. So I got pretty involved, but I got mostly involved.
So you think Joe did this?
No. I think Joe was a helper. And the reason he used mental patients is because you can't take him to court.
In addition to talking to Joe about the case and asking him questions about the sexual assault of John and all sorts of things, he did photo lineups. And he did lineups of different necklaces to see if Joe could pick out the one John had been wearing and things like that. When I interviewed Acker in prison, he told me that during the photo lineup, Joe picked the actor from the Dukes of Hazzard as one of the killers. But Acker just thought, you know, he's got a developmental disability. He was probably just wrong about that one, but he's right about all the other stuff. Joe's doctors back at the time told the police that he was easily led, that he tried to be a con man, that his developmental disability made him very childlike, and that if somebody told him to say something, he would say it. Joe's in his 60s now, and so I talked with both his father and his sister, who is his legal guardian, and they said that he is just loyal to a fault. So if he had someone who he considered a friend, he would stick with protecting that person. Acker was visiting him all the time. He was making him feel important. And his family would say Acker was just manipulating Joe. Acker would take his theory about Joe the patient to John's family, including his older brother Mark, and to the police, and ultimately to the media. After John's body was found, Acker struck up a correspondence with John's parents. And so he actually met them, talked on the phone with them, wrote them letters, went to dinner at their house a couple of times, tried to get Mark to go to ball games with him and things like that. In getting close with John's family, Acker may have had access to information about the official police investigation. And he also probably had access to photos of John, including some of the ones police found in Acker's photo album about John's case. Some of these photos, I believe, and the police believe, John's family actually gave him because his mother grew to consider Acker a friend. Mark Zara, John's older brother, wonders how Acker could have gotten some of those photos. Particularly, there are some photos of Mark and his brother Phil when they were much older than they were when John died. So where did that come from? Some of these photos appear as if Acker was conducting surveillance and taking the pictures himself of John's house and of Franklin High School and different locations that were significant to the crime. And as time went on, Dan Acker developed a relationship with Engelbart, where he would write him all of these letters talking about his different theories in the case, things that Joe the patient had said that made Dan think Joe witnessed the murder. And in Acker's journal, he would say things like, "I am now officially a part of this investigation. I am assisting Special Agent Engelbart with the John Zara murder." So for whatever reason, after Acker was questioned by Engelbart, Acker was really drawn to him and, you know, decided that he was going to be his partner in solving the crime. Here's Detective Kent Schoonover, who you heard in the last episode, talking about Acker's involvement with the police, including Special Agent Engelbart, who worked for the Justice Department's Division of Criminal Investigation, or DCI for short.
He professed to be a private investigator, saying he feels compelled to solve this case for John's benefit and the benefit of the family, to give the family justice. And he became a nuisance over the years for the Franklin Police Department, Hales Corners Police Department, for DCI. He came up with his own theories. He came up with his own suspects, things of that nature. Very odd, but he was dismissed by those departments early on in the investigation, but he persisted and became kind of a pain.
Acker really ticked off the police in 1978. WTMJ-TV had been looking into the problems with the investigation into John's death. We've been playing you audio from that investigation throughout the series. Acker approached the TV reporter and offered his theory about Joe the patient. He told the television reporter that the police hadn't looked into Joe's involvement at all. We're going to play an extended clip of that segment now. The reporter agreed to conceal Acker's identity, which is why his voice may sound distorted.
This was to have been the end of our series, The Zira File. However, a few weeks ago, a man approached the Ziras, claiming to have information from a source who may have been in Whitnall Park when John Zira died. The man, who we will call Dan, admitted that he himself had been a suspect in the case, but had passed a lie detector test. The test results were confirmed by police. Dan described a series of conversations with a resident at a mental institution who said he saw somebody killed in Whitnall Park, a kid. As Dan's source called him, a kid named John. Dad tried to confirm it with a photograph.
My source took the photo, looked at it carefully, was hesitant, and finally said, "I think I know the boy in the middle. I think that's John."
Dan explained that he'd gone to police with part of that information 2 years ago. We determined, however, that police never questioned the resident of the mental facility. So News 4 decided to talk to him. What he told us was amazingly precise and similar to police knowledge of the Zira death. He seemed to know things that even police didn't know. For instance, the Ziras said their son rarely cursed, but when he did, it was always the same words. Dan quotes his source.
The boy was crying. The boy stated to one of the assaulting males, the boy said to him, or called him, a son of a bitch. Quote, that's a quote. And he was then slapped by one of the assaulting males and told to shut up and not speak and to lay down on the ground.
When Acker went on TV and told his theory about Joe the patient being a witness to John's murder, that's when the police really lost patience with him, because that whole TV series was making the police look bad in the first place. And then you've got Acker saying, "I've talked to this guy who witnessed the murder and the police don't believe me and they've never even talked to this guy." Joe was really never on the suspect list. When the police went and talked with him after the TV story that Dan Acker did, Joe couldn't even pick a picture of John Zira out of a photo lineup. He pointed to another kid named John who actually lived across the street from Joe's parents and said that was the kid who had gotten killed in the park. He just didn't say anything that made sense. And his family tells me he has the cognitive abilities of about a 7 or 8 year old. So he was never really on the list. And then when the police went back and talked to him in the early 2000s, Joe just really had no idea what they were even talking about. Acker is completely convinced, he tells me, that Joe witnessed the crime. And he tells me that God wants him to help solve the crime. And he's either convinced of that, or he has some sort of mental problem where he thinks that's true. Or the more nefarious theory, of course, is that he killed John himself and he's trying to put the blame off on somebody else. I'm not sure which one of those is actually true. Acker and I exchanged several letters. Here are some excerpts from some of his letters to me, read by a narrator from our newsroom.
Once the police talked to me and I gave them what I had, I was basically shunned. Joe was looked at as, no way could he be involved. Gina, they are wrong. I don't have all the right answers, but Joe knew too much. I recently prayed one night that the perpetrators of this horrible deed will be found, not for my self-interest or gain, but for a loving family and a most kindly young man who deserved to live out his life. Had this been a young female victim, I would have done the same. A few days after I prayed, your letter came. I think we will need his higher divine power to get to the truth.
The police take on it is that Dan Acker got to know John's family. They told him enough information about the case that he could kind of feed it to this other guy and get a so-called confession or witness statement from this mental patient. It sounds like a movie. It sounds like a TV show. It doesn't necessarily sound like reality to me. But I don't really know what to think about him. Mark was 15 years old when John was killed. He said he never liked Acker, and he couldn't figure out why he kept coming around.
I remember him coming to my parents' house on more than one occasion. I remember having either Christmas or Thanksgiving or some kind of dinner with him. Him sitting at my parents' dining room table and having dinner with us, and I just didn't like the guy. I thought the guy was a creep from the first time I ever met him.
John's mother, she didn't know what to think. I don't think that they were necessarily convinced that he did it, but they also weren't surprised that he turned out to be a child molester. For Schoonover and other detectives today, Acker remains this confusing piece of the puzzle. We know now that crimes like this will be revisited by the perpetrator. It's their way of reliving it and continuing to derive pleasure from it. But what does Acker's strange behavior mean for cops like Schoonover decades later?
Hard to read him sometimes. Hard for me to say, does he really feel for the family, or is he under the textbook thing of a serial killer or a predator pedophile where the textbook is, I don't give this up because if I don't give it up, I still own it. John is still mine. I still own John. I don't know. I don't know which is the case. When I talked to him about the Zira case, the only real emotion he ever expressed is, you're making me uncomfortable. I want you to slide back a little bit. I don't like you being right there. I don't like you accusing me. But it wasn't any yelling, screaming, raised voice or anything like that. He has a very monotone voice. I still think he's an extremely viable suspect in this case. And we're going to see where that goes.
Next time on Unsolved. Michael Yaporsky was a substitute teacher and part-time hall monitor at Franklin High School back in 1976. And when the police did their initial canvas of all the teachers and students at the school, he told them that most likely he was on his lunch break, alone with his newspaper at the time that John went missing.
I did not either accidentally or on purpose take the life of John Zira.
Unsolved is produced by Katie O'Connell and narrated by me, Gina Barton, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Bill Schultz. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved.